Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to episode 11 of Old Brother, a podcast about Salford / Manchester's legendary musical institution, The Fall. Every week we invite along a guest to chat about their experiences and memories of the group. You can find us at Spotify, Apple and all the usual suspects. We're actually hosted at play.acast.com/s/Old Brother. All episodes are also available on YouTube. You can search for Old Brother Podcast and subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. This week we're joined by founder member of the Blue Orchids, The Fates, Poppycock and of course The Fall, Una Baines. Hope you enjoy it. Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Old Brother, a podcast about The Fall, starring me, Paul Hanley, and my ever-brilliant brother, Stephen. Played bass in The Fall for 73 years, I think, is what he said last time.
I like it.
Yeah, so and we're very lucky to be joined today. You what?
We are lucky.
Yeah, we are. Yeah, to be joined.
I'm just agreeing with you.
Yeah, well, let me say something before you agree with me. Halfway through a sentence, we're very lucky, as Steve will attribute. We're lucky to be joined by Una Baines, former founding member of The Fall, and the Blue Orchids, and the Fates, and various other bands which we'll talk about. But good afternoon, Una. How are you?
Hiya.
Hello.
Hi, Paul. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Are you well?
Yeah, I'm not bad, thanks.
Yes, okay. So we're going to go back, if you'll pardon the expression, which I believe is a Fall lyric.
Back in time.
It is, correct. The first thing I was going to ask you about was pre The Fall, and we talked to Martin about this. So you were kind of a gang, really, weren't you? You four.
Yeah, we were all mates, yeah.
Yeah, you wanted to call them a gang, would?
Well, not in a troublemaker sense, no.
I don't think we refer to ourselves as a gang.
So did Martin and Tony meet you through Mark, is that right?
Yeah, well, how we met them was because we were listening to records at Mark's, and Mark's sisters brought Martin and Tony home, so that's how we met them.
Ah,
I think Barbara was going out with Tony, yeah, and that's how we met them. And Tony and Mark struck up a kind of very competitive conversation about music,
right,
almost immediately, and that's how I remember it.
Okay, because you came pretty close pretty quickly then, didn't you? Or certainly musically, that's the impression I get anyway.
Well, yeah, we were all kind of into the same music, more or less.
Yeah.
I mean, I was into T-Rex and Martin was. Matt wasn't very keen. But we were all into the Velvets and the Stooges. So yeah, that was a common thing. But we were listening to all sorts of music.
And what about Tony? Was he the same?
Yeah, he was really into Jethro Tull at that time, right at the beginning.
When we spoke to Martin, and it's in all the books, that the thing that turned it from talking about music into actually thinking you could form a band was the Sex Pistols. Is that true for you as well?
I think Mark had already thought about having a band. You know, when I first met him, he talks about having a band.
Well, that was years before, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, he always
I think that's the thing, isn't it? We all talked about it, but
yeah,
seeing them kind of...
Yeah, it was a big inspiration.
Made you think you could do it for yourself, yeah?
Yeah, definitely. Because I think Sex Pistols really got rid of that separation between the band and the audience.
Yeah.
And,
well, that's what everybody says. I mean, that's what Pete Shelley and Howard Devoto say, that they were kind of given the impetus to do it. It seems to be what everybody says, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And I remember seeing him, I think it might have been, I'm not sure if it's the Electric Circus, but I remember John Lydon sat on the stage just chatting to people like it was really, like, normal and a breath of fresh air.
I don't think you'd have got that at a Jethro Tull concert, would you?
Possibly not, but I've never seen them myself, so I don't know.
Him sat there at his codpiece with his flute.
that's a revelation to me.
Is it true you were going to be the drummer at first?
Yeah, but money was tight, really. I was working at Prestwich Hospital and it wasn't a massive wage, and drum kits are quite expensive.
That's exactly what happened to me.
Really?
I wasn't working at Prestwich Hospital, but it was a choice between buying a drum kit or a motorbike, and I went for the motorbike.
Right.
Okay. So then I ended up getting the bass was a lot cheaper.
All right. It's the real things turn out, isn't it, fate-wise?
Yeah. I mean, having said that, You must have gone for that Snoopy electric piano. Can't have been the most expensive instrument in the world, can it?
No. When I bought that, the next week in Sounds, because Sounds used to review keyboards, and it got slated as one of the worst sounding keyboards ever.
Yeah. Good timing.
It was a very tinny sound, and I think it only had about three sounds on it. One was like a fairground sort of sound that I really loved, and this very thin piano sound. I don't remember the other sound on it. I'm not sure.
By the time I inherited it, it had one sound, one very thin piano sound.
Oh, really? And the other broke.
Well, yeah, I mean, it lasted a while. I think I got rid of it in 83.
Right.
So that's 6 years for that electric piano. It's not bad.
It did really well.
I've got a feeling there was two of them.
What's Mark had one?
Yeah.
Not Riley. But he took that with him and he left, and I got back with the old one.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Piece of junk by then.
Oh, I thought it might possibly have been stashed at Mark's, actually. I was hoping I might get it back.
Well, it might still be there now, yeah. But, I mean, it was kind of your signature sound, really, for all we're taking the mickey out of it. That fall, that keyboard sound was kind of informed the fall sound, didn't it?
Well, the kind of tinny... It worked for the fall, didn't it?
Yeah.
You know, especially with things like Industrial Estate, that kind of clanky...
Yeah, machine. It made it a lot less like a sort of punk thing, didn't it? And made it a bit more, what the hell's this?
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it.
So, yeah, I believe you didn't have it in time for the first gig, is that right?
No, I was in the audience at the first gig. I think my first gig was Stuff the Jubilee at the Squat.
3rd of June 1977, my notes tell me.
All right, was that when it was?
Apparently. Yeah.
Yeah, so that was a good gig.
The Squat, was it?
The Squat, yeah, I think so. I think that was my first gig. I played God Save the Queen with a fuzz box.
Oh, very nice.
I was trying to do Jimi Hendrix, so it all exploded.
Oh, right, okay.
Explosions when you played God Save the Queen. And then somebody said, get on with it.
So that will have been a lot of the stuff that was on the first album, wasn't it? And the first EP you were playing then, was it?
Yeah, the first. Yeah, we were doing it's like things like Frightened. Race Hatred was a song that I don't think ever got recorded, which was very powerful. What else did we... Oh, Your Heart Out.
Your Heart Out, wow.
Yeah, we played
I didn't know that was that early. Was it the same tune, or...?
Oh, I don't know.
Blimey. He never let words go, did he?
No, I mean, we played that for Elvis on the night. Elvis died...
Wow. Where did you play then that night?
Oh, you know, everybody else will know better than me what gigs were when.
Well, it won't have been the Electric Circus.
No, it
because,
wasn't.
I know that because.
It definitely wasn't the Electric Circus.
Buzzcock signed to United Artists at the Electric Circus the day Elvis died. So. Busy day in Manchester, obviously.
Well, Mark got into it. Mark wasn't really an Elvis fan, it was me who was an Elvis fan. And I think he kind of dismissed him as. You know, because it was his white suit era.
Right.
But I think then when he heard his early stuff, like the Sun Studio stuff, he really got into him.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Because you forget these days that, because you can listen to everything now, it was really hard to get hold of some of that stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah?
Well, we had Rare Records, didn't we, in town at that time?
Oh, yes. Where was Rare? Was that behind Rotters? Oh, that was Yanks, wasn't it?
High. Was it
Rare Records was...
Was it High Street?
Wasn't it near Pips then at the cathedral? Somewhere around there?
Yeah, it was somewhere around there.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Yeah, because us school kids used to go in and get things like, you know, Sam the Shaman, the Pharaohs, Woolly Bully, stuff like that that you couldn't get at the regular record shops.
No. It was all, what's it, wasn't it? It was all Mike Oldfield at Virgin.
No, was it?
Virgin was kind of a, wasn't quite the same. It wasn't like a mega store then, was it? Virgin, where was Virgin? Was that on Newton Street?
Newton Street, wasn't it? No.
Was it? On Market Street?
No, I think it was somewhere else before it was on Market Street.
Market Street, right.
No, it's just a tiny little shop.
Yeah.
Them listening booths.
Yeah.
I've got a vague memory of that.
They were great listening booths.
Oh, yeah, you could go in with headphones, couldn't you?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And there was lots of adverts for people looking for bands and looking for band members all over the wall.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that where, maybe that's where they put the advert for Yvonne?
Possibly.
So, hang on, we're moving too far ahead here. You've not played the electric... So, the first thing you were on was Short Circuit, Live Electric Circus. So that you were on that, weren't you?
Yeah.
You did two tracks on there.
What did we do? Last Orders and Stepping Out.
I think it was, yeah. I don't know why I'm saying I think it was. I know full well it was.
I wore
my copy out.
Yeah.
That was great, though.
That's funny. I bought that on the day it came out and took it round to Mark's, and he didn't have a copy.
Blimey. But did it come out a while after the end? I'm assuming it was a while after the end of the Electric Circus. It took a while to come out, did it?
Yeah.
And then I believe the next thing was Buzzcocks and Richard Boone paid for you to do the Bingo Masters EP.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Because it was at the same place. That was at Indigo. What was that like, Indigo Studios?
Yeah, it's a funny thing for me to remember that because I was actually starting to get quite ill at that point in time.
Oh, blimey.
So my memories are all a bit skew-whiff. Right. But I do remember being really excited that we were doing a recording. But I don't remember much else about it, to be quite honest.
Indeed. I mean, it was quite a big thing to go in a studio in them days, wasn't it?
It was, and yeah, it was brilliant of Richard Boone to support us doing that.
Yeah. I mean, they helped everybody out, didn't they, I think?
Yeah, they were brilliant. I mean, they gave us a lot of breaks. We did a lot of gigs with Buzzcocks.
Yeah. I don't think they get quite the credit they deserve. I mean, they get a fair bit of credit, but they were really instrumental in building that scene up, weren't they?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and with Joy Vivian as well.
Yeah?
Yeah, New Hormones was a really important label in Manchester.
Mm-hmm. So, without being indelicate, was it the fact that you were getting ill, was that the reason you left?
Yeah, it was.
Right.
It was. I'd started learning the new stuff for Witch Trials. And I just couldn't do it. I half learned most of the new stuff, and obviously I knew all the old stuff, like Frightened and everything. But I literally just couldn't do it, and I had to leave.
Oh, dear.
And I really didn't want to, and I used to listen to The Fall all the time on John Peel for the next year.
That must have been difficult, to be out of that when it was just kind of taking off.
Yeah, it was. And then I actually went to see The Fall at Prestwich, when they played for the staff at Prestwich Hospital.
Oh, I was at that, yeah.
Oh, were you?
I was, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I think I remember meeting you the first... That may have been the first time at King's Hall.
All right.
When The Fall played.
Were they headlining?
No, in Bellevue. Were they not... Were they not supporting Public Image? Were they not? Oh.
No, not me. I wasn't on it.
I'm going to get in trouble for this.
You will. Fall obsessives will be telling you off. Was it Buzzcocks at King's Hall? Possibly.
Maybe, yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
Well, there they are again.
All right, somebody will ring in and tell you.
I'm sure they will. So then, by the time you got to join to start the Blue Orchids, you were a bit better then, I presume, were you?
Yeah, I was kind of off the planet for about a year. I mean,
right.
We're kind of skipping over here where you joined Staff 9 for a bit.
Oh, we are actually. Yeah, because I used to carry that keyboard, Snoopy, on two buses.
Yeah.
To rehearse with you in that garage.
In that garage in Stretford, yeah.
And then I'd get there and we'd rehearse for about half an hour and then I'll go to the pub.
That sounds about right.
That's about right, yeah.
What kept you rehearsing that long?
But at that time I knew I was getting ill, but it's like I could fake that I was okay. You know, I carried that off for as long as I possibly could. And then, when Eric joined The Fall, he used to ring me up and say, come on, Una, just one more gig, you know. And I'd go, okay. And then I'd do it. And then we did one in London at that place near Buckingham Palace.
The ICA?
That's it, that's the one. And I had a weird, what would you call, not a hallucination, but it's like people's lives were on the line, you know, like John Lydon and my life, and there was going to be this big explosion and it was all, you know, things were going to kick off. And I couldn't play a note. I was just touching the notes with my finger, not knowing what I was doing. And the funny thing is, it got a really great review. People thought that was all part of the act.
Ooh. I mean, you can laugh about it now, but it must have been terrifying at the time.
Well, it was, but I can definitely laugh about it now because some of it was really funny. It genuinely was.
So how were the rest of the group with you? Were they understanding or were they kind of...
I think people didn't know what to do and people didn't really know how ill I was either. It's a hard thing to understand what's... I mean, I'd never had a breakdown before. I'd worked at Prestwich Hospital, but I really wasn't working with people who were having breakdowns. Mainly it was like elderly women who had nowhere else to go. They weren't really mentally ill. Well, they probably would have to have been in Prestwich Hospital, but, they were just elderly people who had been drugged up. So I wouldn't have known how to respond to somebody having a breakdown.
And bands aren't the most understanding about stuff like that, really, are they?
Well, it's like, people, well, you know, it's like any work, isn't it? You want your work to carry on. You know, you want to, you know, if you lose the momentum in music, it can be the death knell for a band.
Yes. It wasn't. It must have been, because I don't think people quite understood it the same then, did they? I think you'd have a bit more sympathy these days. Well, you'd like to think so, wouldn't you?
Well, yeah, I think that. I mean, I always wanted to speak about it because I didn't. I wanted it to come from me and not from Chinese whispers, if you know what I mean. So it's something I'd like to write about because there are some really hilarious incidents along with the difficult things. So
yeah.
Yeah, it'd be good to get it out. I think that taboo needs breaking down because so many people suffer from mental health issues and, you know, and become very isolated and don't have a voice.
Yes. That would be an amazing thing to write about. You should do it, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I do want to do that. I've always wanted to do that. I've always wanted to write an expose on Prestwich Hospital.
Really?
Yeah, because... when I worked there, all I could do when I came home was go to the pub and drink and talk about Prestwich Hospital non-stop.
Yeah.
What was going on there, you know. And there wasn't a lot you could do, you know. You could be, you know, caring and towards people, but the regime was in place and you couldn't change it. You couldn't change it. The teachers used to sort of send you out there like you were going to, but they said you can't come back to us. In other words, you go out there as a student nurse, you try to change something, you've got no backup.
Right.
So it was, you couldn't do it. And after a couple of years, I mean, to be quite honest, it affects you. It affects you. You can't do a job in that type of an institution for too long before it really damages you.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the fall was happening and I made a very difficult choice at one point that I couldn't do both things.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I thought it was great doing the fall because we were putting some of those things into the... Matt was putting them into the lyrics, like repetition. Yes. I mean, I wasn't around when Roche Rumble came out, but I was so excited when that song came out. I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah.
So... yeah, it was great. It was like another way of getting it out.
Uh-huh.
A great release, really.
Yeah. Well, you did some lyric writing in the fall as well, didn't you?
Yeah, not a lot.
You did Dresden Dolls was one of yours, I believe.
Yeah, and Tony wrote the music for that.
Right.
It's a pity we didn't develop it a bit more because it had a bit of a Spanish twist to it.
Right.
And that doesn't really come out.
Great song, yeah.
Yeah, it could, you know, it could have been more developed. The guitar was brilliant on it. I just loved it.
And did it have an effect on you the way the band was going? Were you not happy with that as well?
Oh, you mean... Ah, I know what you mean.
Well, must have had an effect, I think.
Well, I think what happened... I mean, it was a really weird time because everything was speeding up. The fall were becoming very respected and popular. But me and Mark were drifting apart. We were splitting up. But we'd never say to each other that we were splitting up. And just to correct something Martin said, we weren't in an open relationship. We never...
Well, he obviously thought you were.
we never decided we were in an open... We just couldn't... It was like we couldn't tell each other, that's it, it's over. It just happened. And then when Mark told me he had feelings for somebody else... That's when I knew it was finally over.
Right.
That wasn't Kay, by the way, but I'm not going to reveal who it was.
Okay.
Fair enough.
So it wasn't a very healthy situation at all, really, was it?
It was a crazy situation. Oh, and the other thing I want to correct is Kay was not my best friend at the hospital. I had a mutual friend who had a friend, which was Kay.
Yeah.
Needed somewhere to live because she'd split up from a partner who was one of the senior nurses at the hospital. And I had a room, so I offered her a room. I hadn't met her, but I was introduced to her by this friend and I offered her a room. So that's what happened.
Right.
She was a year ahead of me in nursing, so we never worked together. You know, that's a bit of a myth. We weren't best buddies and worked together at the hospital. But on saying that, I mean, you know, we did become friends
Yes.
And she introduced me to the tarot, which is something that I really value. Not that I believe in fortune telling, because I don't. But I think it's a useful kind of tool. Like, you could use it in a way like counselling, because it's like imagery, and it gets people to talk about stuff in an easier way, because you're looking at these symbols and...
Like sort of Rorschach kind of thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And it's quite the symbolism in it, it's like a universal language, really. And it goes back a long way. Nobody really knows where the roots of it come from. But it's a very it's a very developed system, and it fits into a mathematical framework and all different sort of astrological framework, all different things. I just find it quite fascinating.
Yeah.
That's it, really.
Yeah.
So she did
I suppose it gets tarnished with that fortune teller nonsense,
definitely.
I suppose, doesn't it?
I really, really think it's bullshit, the whole fortune telling stuff. And I think it's people who are very good at manipulating, or very good at reading people, reading the body language or whatever. Yeah. And then they can say very general things, and people go, oh, that's spot on, you know.
Yeah. See, when you say I'm an Aquarius, we don't believe in any of that horoscope nonsense either.
No, definitely.
Sorry, it's an old joke, but
yeah.
Right. So, the blue orchids I wanted to ask you about.
Oh, yeah. Well, when I started recovering from my breakdown, and me and Martin started seeing each other, and I got well again, and we got a flat.
Yeah.
And because the breakdown had been quite profound, it was like nothing could hurt me after that. It's like nothing could touch me. It's hard to explain, but that's what it felt like.
Yeah.
And Martin had missed a couple of rehearsals. One was to take me to the doctor because I'd developed asthma, and I had a very bad asthma attack, and he took me to the doctor. And the other one was he was bodyguard for Iggy Pop at a gig at the Ranch Bar, him and Eric. And I was sleeping. I slept a lot because I'd not slept for nearly a year, not slept, very high-wired or whatever you'd call it, and I couldn't come down and I couldn't relax, when I got better, all I wanted to do was sleep all the time. So one afternoon I'd arranged to go with Eric's partner Jane to go and see Iggy Pop at the ranch, and not the ranch, the Russell, and I heard a knock on the door, and I went downstairs and opened the door, and it was Kay, really kind of angry, and she came upstairs and I was going, oh, sit down, would you like a brew and all that? She sort of laid into me and kind of said, Martin's missed rehearsals because of you, and he's done this because of you. And I said, actually, he's like working for Alan Wise, and he's like a bodyguard for Iggy Pop, who's been his idol since he was like a teenager.
Yeah.
And she was just not having it, really. She was furious. And it meant nothing to me. It was like water off a duck's back. There was like nothing that could have touched me at that time. It's like, no, I'm just coming through this thing now.
Yeah.
So not affecting me. It was just weird. Anyway, so...
That was the day Martin left.
Well, it is. And the thing is, when I told him what she'd done, what had happened, and he said, that's it, I've had enough, I'm leaving. And I really do... I said, don't. Do not leave, because they're going to blame me. That's what's going to happen. But anyway, he did, in the end, he did. I think he said he'd had enough anyway, of the way it was becoming a bit of a dictatorship and,
That was very different to how you started out, really, wasn't it?
Well, really different. It's like, in a way, it was like they were like the mum and dad, and everybody else was like a bunch of kids. It was that.
Yeah, I was that little kid.
That's actually what it was like for us. Yeah.
What are you talking about, like with Mark? He was like the same age.
Yeah.
But she was 10 years older. And I also used to wonder what it'd be like to be 29, because in a way, to me, Kay reminded me of 29 going on about 69, the way she kind of went on. It was like a very, I don't know, it was something very old-fashioned. Is it Northern Lancashire or something?
Yeah.
You know, I'm not trying to be insulting, but it was a certain type of a character.
Yeah.
And it was very different to what we'd been used to, you know. Which was, we weren't used to anything because we didn't have a manager. And we, you know, we just made decisions mutually. I don't even know how we made decisions, really. So, but anyway, anyway, I mean, she obviously did a lot of great things for the band afterwards. So, you know, what can I say? It's like, that was the next phase.
I was going to ask you about that, but, you know, it's sliding doors kind of a moment. How would that original lineup have gone on? Would they have gone on to great things, or would it fizzled out? Or because sometimes you need somebody who's not, you know, who's not just drifting along, don't you? I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I didn't believe in managers. We were very idealistic, and I don't know if that was sustainable. You know. You know, we were very young. I think it's like partly to do with how young we were, you know, and what you're going through at that age. And I think, you know, yeah, it's difficult to say. I mean, it is what it is, isn't it? It evolved into what it became.
Yeah.
It carried on with its many evolutions over time.
But it's amazing the difference, though, isn't it? Between what the band was when you were in them and then even 3 years later, it was a completely different band, really, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. And it was obviously more sustainable.
Yeah. That big change for me is that once you start the keyboards in the Blue Orchids, they're completely different from the Fall, weren't they? I mean, they still informed the sound, but it was a bit more epic, really, wasn't it, what you played in them?
Because I think it felt to me like a completely new beginning. And, and it gave me a real chance to develop musically. Yeah. And to try lots of new things. It was like that for me, on a musical level, it was just an amazing exploration of different things.
Yeah.
That's no criticism of the Fall, because that was the beginning for me. And it was very simple. I played single notes or two or three chords.
Yeah.
Maybe four max. Whereas I was learning to play melodies and things like that in the Blue Orchids.
Yeah.
It was a whole different thing altogether.
So what was that like then, coming back and playing again? Did it feel a bit better by that stage, I presume?
Did it feel more comfortable?
Yeah, it did. I felt like I had lots of room to kind of grow and experiment.
So how long were you with them then, Blue Bot? You were there for quite a while, weren't you?
So I think it was at 86.
Yeah.
I mean, there had been some gaps as well, but...
So why did that come to an end, do you think?
Well, me and Martin came to an end.
Ah, right, okay. That explains that then.
Yeah, and, you know, so it was the band and Martin and lots of other really difficult things going on in my life at that time.
Right. Then you kind of stepped away for a while, did you?
Well, no, just as the Blue Orchids were splitting up, I told Jeff Travis that I had an album that I wanted to record and that it was exactly like the Blue Orchids.
Right.
So he gave me a very small budget, and that's when I did the Furia album.
Right, okay. I was going to ask about that, because that really, really couldn't be any more different to the Folk, could it? That's kind of almost like folk, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's like a kind of folky type, gothy type album.
Yeah.
But, while I was in the Blue Orchids, I was also in a women's band called Beyond the Glass.
Right.
They did a lot of, I mean, it was all original material. They all wrote different songs. A lot of it was very soul and, I don't know, soul and funk.
Right.
It was great learning, like, just different way. And we did, you know, Van Morrison's Moon Dance.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we did a few fantastic, and it was a lot of women with amazing voices, mainly one family,
who
were just so talented, and they're still kind of, all their daughters and grandchildren and all the boys as well, well, the men now, play guitars and bass and drums and sing. It's like a big kind of musical dynasty, really. So the Fates was a lot of that family plus other musicians that I knew. And it was only half written when we went in the studio. And it was actually Tony Friel's studio.
Right.
In Old Trafford.
Okay.
He recorded that. He did loads of it for free. And, yeah, his partner Lynn was involved in it, and she sang with us and played percussion and stuff. But it was a kind of a... It was half written, so the rest of it was made up in the studio. And I'd just make a big pan of stew. We were drinking, like, herb teas and stuff and made this album.
Right. Because some of the singing on that, the harmonies and things are amazing, aren't they?
Yeah, they're really beautiful voices, and I'm still working with some of those people.
Right.
Some of the blues.
And can people get this, then?
What, new stuff or the Beyond the Glass stuff?
The Beyond the Glass.
Well, you can't, but Janet, who's also a really brilliant engineer, has got all their tapes and stuff. So I'm sure she'll be glad for this bit of publicity.
Right.
Because, you know, I've been... Really, some of it is so brilliant, it should be, you know, it should be released.
Yeah, well, because that Fates album was really well received, wasn't it? And you reissued that, didn't you?
It wasn't. It's well received on the reissue.
Yeah.
It wasn't well received when it came out at all. No.
But you put that out yourself, didn't you?
Yeah, because Rough Trade didn't think it was good enough.
Right.
So it came out on Taboo Records.
They were too busy with the Smiths then, weren't they?
Well, yeah, they were always too busy with the Smiths.
That's the one-line review of Rough Trade, always too busy with the Smiths. Brilliant. So how did you come to do that comic then? You know, you were talking about writing. How did you end up with that comic about you and Mark?
Well, funnily enough, it was this couple from Australia... I needed somewhere to stay, so I put them up at my house. It turned out the guy, Keith McDougall, was a massive Fall fan, and he was a comic artist.
Right.
So, I mean, because I've been thinking about doing a book for years, and people keep telling me do a book. And I've been, you know, writing bits and bobs over the years, but I thought it'd be interesting to do a comic.
Yeah.
You know, something quite short and concise. And also I wanted to write something pre the fall.
Yeah.
Because that time before the fall, for me, was a pretty special because there was no madness going on in the life.
Yeah.
It was peaceful. It felt like time went on forever, like you do when you're 16 and it's
the
6 weeks holidays feel like they go on forever, you know, and all that kind of thing. So, yeah, I wanted to capture that, really. And also the, you know, kind of acid experience.
Yeah.
I wanted to encapsulate that and, you know, all the different political things that were going around at the time. Because it was a very interesting place in Manchester in the early 70s. I mean, the women's movement was really big. People were not really big in it, as in publicly, but there were lots of small groups where women were learning about what was going on in different countries to women, what sort of politics were shaping women's lives or restricting them or stopping them from having access to things. Mm-hmm. Not that a lot. I mean, it has changed a bit, but it's not. I mean, look at what's happening in Afghanistan now.
Yeah.
And it's horrible, isn't it? And it's like, but we have made some headways, like, because in the early 70s, we didn't have rape crisis centres. We didn't have women's refuges. I mean, women were fighting to create those things then, and they did create them.
Yeah.
And it's really important that they exist and that they happened. And it was all that mixture of politics and music and, you know, the punk thing came along and it was like a real outburst of all of those ideas, all of those feelings, everything that young people were going through just came out in one big burst of energy. That's how I
Yeah.
Well, I experienced it.
Yeah.
And it was over very quickly, really. I'd say, what, a year, 18 months before it become a bit hijacked and, you know, and it evolved into something else, which is what happens, isn't it?
Yeah.
Things keep evolving and changing. So,
I think the canny people moved on pretty quickly, didn't they, I think? And you ended up with that kind of second generation of punk bands, which weren't really up to much. But the first lot weren't really, and the Fall included, and you, they weren't like people think punks are, do they?
No, not at all, no.
No, definitely not. I think
that was just a very short-lived thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
And it became a cliche very soon, pretty quickly.
Yeah, and the media are very good at doing that as well, though, aren't they, and reducing important things that happen. Because if you remember, the Sex Pistols were banned.
Yeah?
They were actually banned because they were going to corrupt the nation, you know. And, well, if you're going to corrupt what? A nation that's already totally corrupt.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's astonishing to think they were actually banned from playing.
I know. I mean, I often think, you know, this film of that Presbyterian minister outside a Sex Pistols gig going on about, you know, how bad it is, and what did they think was going on in there? It's only a band playing some songs.
Yeah, well, they were anti-establishment songs, weren't they? So the threat. I remember when I first heard Anarchy in the UK on the radio and really thinking this is the beginning of a really important revolution in this country. Mm-hmm. It was so exciting.
Yeah.
You never thought it'd be allowed, you know, to hear it on the radio.
Yeah. I mean, if people forget just how, I don't know, astonishing they were, the Sex Pistols, really. People didn't know what to do with it, did they?
No. No, not at all. That was it. They were totally taken by surprise, weren't they?
Yeah. So, there was one thing I wanted to ask you before we wrap up. What was it like working with Nico then?
Oh,
did you do your backing band for a while?
I've loved Nico since the first murder, since I was like 16 when.
Yeah.
I listened to the first Velvet Underground and then listened to all the solo stuff, and I just thought she was amazing.
Yeah.
And I couldn't believe it that I got to work with her. It was incredible. And even
she difficult to work with?
I didn't find her difficult to work with.
No.
At all. I don't know if she became difficult later on. I don't know. You know, because we left at one point. We left because it got a bit hair-raising going through customs with her.
She will insist on bringing back that cooked meat from Germany, won't she?
I know. And, you know, we had a baby daughter at home, you know, so...
Yeah.
But, you know, no matter what was going on in her life, she always did a professional gig.
Yeah.
She's a real trooper, and I just think she's an incredible artist. I think her lyrics are astonishing, seeing as English isn't even her first language.
Yeah.
You know, Janitor of Lunacy. Who makes up a title like that? I mean, it's just amazing. Her lyrics are just the whole music. I mean, we used to all be listening to Nico when we were young in Mark's front room, you know, listening to... what was that one with the in Egypt? Desert Shore.
Okay.
Strange lyrics that you couldn't understand some of them. But, just amazing stuff.
It's amazing that to think, you know, when you listen to the Velvet Underground, that she'd end up living in Manchester and you'd end up working with her. That's unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah, and that she was walking down King's Road, which Mark's parents' house was just off King's Road.
Yeah.
She was in the flat there.
It's like bumping into Jim Morrison in the co-op, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, really. Yeah. I mean, I met her at Rafters. It was Ellen White.
So did we, didn't we? We couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just amazing. I love it. She used to let me sound check her keyboards.
Blimey.
That Patti Smith had bought her.
So now, that's too many name drops in one sentence, that Una. We're going to have to fine you for that. I'm sorry.
So I was like a little kid in the sweet shop, you know.
So, What are you up to now then? Are you still playing with Papa Cop?
Yeah, we've got our album nearly finished. Most Brilliant. Of it's being mastered as we speak. We're going to go into Noise Boy Studio the beginning of September to record one track. And then I think that's... add a few more vocals, and I think that's going to be it. It's took a long time, but
yeah.
It's been a big, long journey with Poppycock.
Yeah.
I never knew how hard it was to put a band together, really. I mean, because with The Fall, we all joined at the same time, so that makes a massive difference. This was completely different.
Right.
But I want to say thank you very much for inviting me on the big midweek launch.
Oh, that was great, wasn't it? I really enjoyed that.
What a brilliant night. I just loved
that. That was a great night, wasn't it?
And getting to play on four songs that I never dreamt I'd get to play on in a million years.
Yeah.
Was amazing.
Well, no, I never thought I'd end up playing with the original keyboard player of The Fall, so you did a full favour.
We came full circle that night.
Yeah, that was
You never, yeah, you did all them rehearsals with Staff 9. We didn't do any Staff 9 songs, though, did we?
Oh, that's true.
Well, you couldn't do them without Craig, could you?
No.
Did we do one called Popstock?
It was.
Yeah.
And then Matt changed it to Chockstock.
Right, that was... Yeah. There's the only surviving Staff 9 song.
All right, yeah. I don't remember. I'd probably remember the titles if I, heard them. I'd remember them.
Hey, I used them all again in four songs. I knew.
Oh, really?
A few times.
No riff, no never knowingly wasted.
No. Absolutely.
Okay, well, I think that's about it. When's it coming out, the album, then? Is it coming out on vinyl, or is it just download kind of thing?
No, I definitely want it to come out on vinyl. I'm hoping it comes out next spring, but I've got to see who wants to release it first.
Yeah.
So when it's finished, I'll send it to people and see what they think.
Great. And you're back playing live again?
Yeah, we should have been playing at... what's it, Kendall Calling, but it got cancelled.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So we're booked again for next year. Well, I think
hopefully
we're on
next year, then we're back to normal.
Oh, God, who knows, But we're supposed to be at the Night and Day early next year.
Right.
And that's
well,
touch
wood, that takes place.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks for joining us this week on Old Brother. Episodes released every second Friday, so watch for episode 12 in 2 weeks' time. Please follow us on Twitter at Old Brother Show, where you can find a link to Spotify. You can also subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher or RSS, so you'll never have to miss an episode. While you're at it, give us a rating on iTunes or tell your friends about us. For further reading, you can check out our books about The Fall, The Big Midweek and Have a Bleeding Guess, available from Root Publishers and all good bookstores. Hope to speak to you all again soon, and remember, if you're driving, take your car. Ta-ra!
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.